baseball fans, and welcome to a podcast to be named later. I am your host, Chris Mitchell, and we are getting into a lot today. The trade deadline just happened 24 hours ago, actually about 23 hours ago. It closed off at 4 a.m. on Monday. We are doing this podcast on Tuesday, August 2nd. And today we're going to be having George Kurtz on the program from rotoexperts.com, and we're going to be talking about it from a baseball perspective, a little bit, a smidgen of baseball talk as far as normal, standard MLB. I like to make these distinctions. And so we'll talk about it from the impact of baseball and on the races and pennant races and things like that. And but the majority of what we're going to be talking about today will be fantasy baseball. Impact of the trade at the deadline on what's going to happen from a fantasy perspective. And that will give you some insight onto the baseball things, too. So even though we'll be sort of looking at it through the perspective of fantasy baseball, the fact that a lot of our analysis is baseball anyway. So just if you're not a fantasy player or even if you don't like fantasy, we're still going to be talking about baseball. We're going to be talking about what Carlos Beltran means to the Rangers lineup, who wins, who loses, who benefits, who just plain loses at bats, things like that. The benefit of Jonathan Lucroy, the fact that some relievers moved, three of probably the six or eight best closers in baseball, maybe at least the top 10, all were traded to new clubs yesterday. So we'll talk about that, who earns those jobs, and if they will, in fact, be closing in their new locations while wearing their new laundry. So we'll talk about that a little bit. A lot happened. I thought I saw a stat where there were 48 trades made yesterday. And that was the most, I believe, by five that we've ever seen at the trade deadline. So while we didn't see a lot of big guys move, I mean, Jonathan Lucroy is a pretty significant move. Andrew Miller and Aroldis Chapman are pretty big trades. But it's tough to say that a reliever, even an elite one, even an elite closer reliever, is a big name in comparison to what we've seen in years past. We've seen David Price has been traded at two different trade deadlines. CC Sabathia a few years back single-handedly almost carried the Brewers to the playoffs a few years back. That was obviously a significant name that was moved at the deadline. Randy Johnson helped the Houston Astros make it to the playoffs. Curt Schilling did wonders for a multiple of teams when he was traded. Carlos Beltran, who was traded yesterday, was a significant trade way back in the day when he was traded also to the Houston Astros. He single-handedly carried the Astros. So there weren't those kinds of big-time guys that were traded. But there were a lot, and there were some meaningful ones nonetheless. So we'll do the best we can to cover as many of those as possible. And while we'll obviously be focusing on yesterday's trades, we'll look back at some of the early ones. Chapman was traded a few days ago. We saw the Red Sox added Drew Pomeranz for a highly touted prospect, Anderson Espinosa. So we'll get into some of the previous trades as well. But obviously with 48 trades made yesterday, and at least 10 to 15 of them having relatively meaningful fantasy impacts, we'll get, for the most part, into those deals. So that'll be exciting. Again, I'm your host, Chris Mitchell. This is a podcast to be named later. If you want to follow me on Twitter for links to the program or for anything I do as far as writing for minorleagueball.com, writing for rotoexperts.com, or even over at baseballamerica.com, you can find me on Twitter, at CJMitch73, or you can talk baseball with us on the podcast to be named later Facebook page under the same name. But today we're going to be talking with George Kurtz from rotoexperts.com, and let me invite him into the program today. George, great to have you on board. It's been a while. I know that you're a busy, busy man, but how's everything going on in your life these days? We'll get into the baseball in a little bit, but how's everything going on with you? I heard you had a little bit of a pipe issue, or you had a hose issue a week back, which I found – I didn't comment because I couldn't find the right word, but I found it an interesting little post nonetheless.
Yeah, I'm glad my life's travesties interest people. And my kids, I have a 9-year-old girl, 5-year-old girl. Somehow they buried my hose, garden hose, regular garden hose. They buried it in the backyard. Now, you wouldn't think this is any kind of big deal. They're 9 years old. How deep can they possibly bury this? Chris, I dug down as far as I could go. I mean, you're talking maybe 3-4 feet, and I'm yanking on this thing, and I can't get it to come out. Someone with some scientific background is going to have to explain to me how the hose actually dug itself. I'm sure they turned the water on. I had someone say, well, if they turned the water on, it probably created a vacuum, and that's why it stuck. Okay, I get it. But, it's like, you've got to be kidding me. So I ended up, being, technically frustrated male, frustrated dad, cut the hose and buried it.
And while I do take some level of bliss in other people's suffering, and friends even maybe more so than enemies, but with yours, it was the perfect level of, yes, it was a little bit of a tragedy, I suppose, but it wasn't end of the world kind of tragedy. So it's the perfect mix of you can laugh at you without feeling like I'm being a little bit evil. And I don't mind being evil. I'm more than happy. But it would not be anywhere near as interesting if it was something significant. But that was interesting. And again, I couldn't find the right thing to comment. So I just sat there and watched it while you remained puzzled and kind of baffled by this scientific mystery. I guess, is that comparable to maybe the Tom Brady equal gas law, whatever it was? Is that the kind of scientific assistance you need in order to find that thing, or have you just officially retired that sucker to the blows and maybe right down there into hell?
You know, it's not the hose. I don't care about the hose. Yeah, that's no big deal. It's $20, I'll go buy another one. But how did it happen? Yeah, I'm curious as to how this happened. I know it's not the girls, and there's got to be some scientific reason that the hose actually dug itself deeper. Yeah, I don't know what it might be. I'm sure there's a reason. I'm sure there's some kind of law of physics that someone knows. Oh, it's because of this. You know, fine. I'm just curious. I don't really care about the hose anymore. I'm not mad at the girls. That's part of being a dad. That stuff's going to happen. But I do want to know why. I'm that kind of person. I really don't care, but I want to know why. Why did this happen?
No, I'm that way too. It drives me crazy when you can't figure things out. I don't go to magic shows. I get frustrated when people do stupid things. I like to know why. I completely understand. When you say you just want to know why, I unfortunately can completely understand your philosophy and thinking there. Let's transition a little bit back into the real world of baseball and so forth. One last question off baseball before we get back into baseball. And this is something that's been bugging me, and it has to do with beer and bacon. I'm not going to ask you about beer because I know you're not a drinker, and for the most part, neither am I. I don't quite understand why people are obsessed with bacon. Everything is bacon, bacon, bacon. Bacon pizza, bacon in the crust pizza. There's bacon something fries out at Wendy's now. Everyone talks about how amazing bacon is. I like bacon. I think it's fine, but for the most part, I think it's actually a little salty, and I don't even order bacon on my pizza. What is this obsession with the fact that everyone just worships bacon now? It is not the best food in the world. If I had to live on an island for the rest of my life with only one food, bacon wouldn't even be in my top 100 of possible choices. And yet everyone talks about bacon like it's God in human form of some kind. Are you a bacon loony? And can you explain to me a little bit why there is this sudden, in the last year and a half to 2 years, bacon has become this godly food? I don't quite get it.
Well, I think maybe the bacon industry has done a real good job of marketing here. No, I agree. I like bacon. I'm not a loony for it. I haven't had bacon in probably a month, two, whenever it is. And I don't go out and buy it. We don't really make it in the house. But sure, if I go out for breakfast, I'm going to get some bacon strips. I don't mind bacon on my burgers or anything like that. But no, I wouldn't be considered a loony. Listen, it's good. It is salty, like you said. That generally doesn't bother me. I don't like mine well done. I don't want it crispy. I like, regular, normal bacon. So yes, I enjoy it, but I enjoy it a normal amount. Maybe because I also don't want to die of a heart attack.
Yeah, again, I actually like sausage better. I even like ham better in a lot of cases with my breakfast, or at least in an omelet. So I guess that's sacrilege. I don't know. It seems like bacon has this level of insanity that I don't quite fully understand. And the same thing goes for beer. I remember when Peter King, I always read his Monday Morning Quarterback articles, and he started talking about coffee and beer. He started with beer, and then he went on to coffee nerdness. And it seems like these days, I guess this will be my final question before we actually talk about something that matters here. Are you feeling the peer pressure? Because it seems like sports writers now, you have to be obsessed with beer, or you're just not quite one of them. Have you ever got that sense that you have to be pressured into caring about these exotic beers? It seems like I see Ian Osiris wrote books about it. He has a website. He writes for Fangraphs, but he has now a site called Beer Graphs because he's so obsessed with beer. I don't know. It just seems like that's another thing. Specifically, and I'm sure it's popular everywhere. My brother likes beer as well, but it seems like sports writers now have taken on that as like an added dimension. It makes them more well-rounded sports person if you have an appreciation for something other than Bud Light.
Well, seeing as though I'm not a drinker, I'm probably the wrong person to ask about this, about any kind of beer. I'm certainly not feeling any pressure about when it comes to beer, whether drinking it or in any other kind of form. So, no, doesn't really affect my everyday life one little bit.
But you have noticed that it seems like more writers are talking about beer. Am I off kilter here, or have you noticed that this seems to be a thing?
Actually, I haven't noticed. But it could also be because I'm not interested in if I don't drink. I don't pay attention to it. If I do see something, I just go on to the next anyway.
All right. I'm looking forward to when I'm looking forward to people starting to talk about Mountain Dew and Mellow Yellow. I'm waiting for that. But I guess you got to be a gamer for that. But I guess that's just the loony tick that is me. I pump up on sugar and caffeine to get through the day. So maybe that's my bad, and so be it. But we're talking baseball here now on a podcast we're doing later. I apologize for going off kilter on these kind of ridiculous stories, though I did think the whole story was a pretty good one. If you followed it all on Twitter for George Kurtz, you would have seen that it was pretty intriguing. But anyway, George, before we get into the actual fantasy aspect, and we'll actually break down a lot of these trades, what were some of your thoughts and impressions about trade deadline day?
Well, there were 18 trades yesterday, not 48. Let's get that straight. It was 48. My God, we'd all still be writing stuff up. 18 trades yesterday. My first thought was how it affected me, all right, because I'm writing the closer report now. And generally when I write the closer report, Chris, it's maybe four or five teams I have to write about, 500-600 words, not a big deal. Right now, I just counted, I have to write about 16 teams. 16. That since last Tuesday have done something. Not necessarily with the closer. It might be a hold guy or a reliever setup man. But 16 teams are going to have to go over. So that was the first thing I'm worried about. All right, how it affects my life. It makes my life harder. A lot of trades. And this is not a surprise. We've seen this now over the past, four or five years, probably longer than that. Teams are always looking for bullpen help at the deadline. And it makes sense because generally those bullpen guys are on shorter contracts. So if you're out of it, you don't really need them. You may not sign up for next year anyway. So you're going to deal those guys, the 7th, 8th inning guys. The fact that more closers went this year, we saw the Yankees with the Marcus, the Miller, Chapman. That was a bit of a surprise that they got so much. Those are the huge deals, with Miller and Chapman. So that was a little bit of a surprise as well. Outside of that, everything else, you said it in the opening, we didn't see the major, major names go as far as you're going to go fantasy. Like no top 30 fantasy players were dealt. Which is not a surprise. Once again, those kind of deals generally we're going to see in the offseason. I didn't expect Chris Sale to go, not unless Texas or the Red Sox are really willing to part with four of their top five players to get Chris Sale. So I'm not surprised at all. I think what people have to realize now, yes, the non-waiver deadline has passed. There'll be more trades in August. Guys are going to float through. Once again, we deal with the closer report. David Robertson is probably going to get through waivers. I don't think anyone's going to claim him, not with a contract. So if the White Sox still want to deal him, they can. And you'll see other players get through, too. So we'll still see some deals, just not quite as impactful as what we've seen over the past week.
Yeah, I wrote about that in my Who to Watch column today over at minorleagueball.com. I mentioned that I was a little surprised that James Shields didn't get traded. So while it looks like maybe the White Sox should be selling, they didn't really full-fledged sell. They didn't. I didn't think Chris Sale was going to move anyway. The price was much too expensive. He was too attractive of a player to be traded. It's a weird way of saying it, but the reality is he's too good and he's too affordable. So guys like that just don't get traded, and that goes for some a lot of the other, Chris Archer is another example and so forth. But I was surprised James Shields didn't. Granted, he's got a little bit of a hefty contract remaining. But he's actually been pitching well. He was pitching pretty poorly for San Diego last season, pitched pretty poorly for the White Sox when he first came over. I think he had, two games in a row where he allowed, 10 earned and then 7 earned in back-to-back outings, one for the Padres and I think one for the White Sox. But in his last 6 outings, he's actually been very good. Granted, the money is a little bit prohibitive, but it's not like it's C.C. Sabathia where he's got 5 years in a ton of money or something, or 3 or 4 years in a ton of whatever C.C. actually officially is. I was a little surprised to see that the White Sox didn't commit to at least trading a little bit, maybe Quintana, but at the very least, I'm surprised that they didn't move on from Shields.
I'm also surprised because you said it. Shields, when he first came over from San Diego, was awful. I mean, God, awful. He was terrible. But he's figured out over his past half dozen starts. Right now, he looks like James Shields of what you expect. So I'm a little surprised, but this is a guy who certainly will clear waivers, so if the White Sox can work a deal. I think why I'm really surprised, Chris, is not so much that it's Shields, but that there are so many teams in playoff contention that need a starter. And you can go up and down the list of the Red Sox, the Orioles, the Blue Jays, the Rangers. They all need starters. This is the American League. You go to the National League, it's going to be close to the same situation there. So I was surprised that more starting pitchers didn't get moved. I think that's what could took me off guard here. I expected these guys to really be changed around. We know the White Sox. I don't blame the White Sox for not trading Sale. I don't think I would either, not unless they were, like I said, the Rangers or Red Sox. And we're talking big deals, Chris. I'm going to bring up the Rangers and Red Sox a lot because those are two teams with very good farm systems, the great farm systems that can really go out and get anybody they want. So I was, I don't blame the White Sox for not making a deal unless the Red Sox or Rangers gave them exactly what they wanted or really close to it. I mean, when it comes to Chris Sale, Yes, he's great. His contract is also great. You know, so I'm not so sure why you'd want to deal him. But if you do, you have to get what you want there. You have to. You just have no choice. So, and you can also make an argument with Sale. You're better off trading him in the offseason when you can involve 29 other teams, not just the teams that are in contention this year. So not surprised he didn't move as well.
Yeah, no, I also wrote about that about 3 or 4 weeks ago over at minorleagueball.com. I titled the article, Relievers Will Be the Rock Stars of This Deadline. And I thought that going back 6 or 7 or 8 weeks, and obviously I think I was proven correct with how many relievers were moved. A lot of relievers were moved. You talk about some of those relievers, you know, a guy like Abad goes to the Red Sox. Does anyone from Fantasy World care about this guy Abad? Of course not. But he's a decent specialist that could have some kind of impact. If you're looking at it from a purely baseball perspective, not only did Melanson, which was a surprise to me, move, not only did I think that Andrew Miller should move, I thought that Chapman should stay because of price, but when you look at what those Yankees got from him, I absolutely agree he should have moved. So I was kind of on board with that. I just didn't – that was, I guess – that I think Aroldis Chapman tells me about just how much I thought relievers would be a big part of this trade deadline, because – I thought originally that Chapman should be kept by the Yankees and offered the qualifying offer because they'd get a first-round pick for it, more than likely. But then when you see what they got in return, they did the right move. They absolutely should have done that trade. When you can get Gleyber Torres for Chapman, that's better than any qualifying offer would possibly bring you. So it made it even surprised me. As much as I thought relievers would be a good get for teams and that this was the market to be selling relievers, for how much they paid for Chapman, that to me really was – that degree of price was surprising to me, and that really signified just how expensive this market was going to be. And we should have seen it coming. I think Dave Dombrowski, I've been giving him a lot of credit over the last week. He saw the price of what relievers would be, and people criticized him for what he paid for Craig Kimbrell, and I think a lot of people even criticized him for what he paid to get Carson Smith, who's been injured all season. They gave up a 200-inning starter in Wade Miley to the Mariners, who then went around and flipped them to the Orioles here at the deadline. I think a lot of people said 200 innings, even though he's a mediocre pitcher and Miley is too much for Carson Smith, who I think would have been one of the elite seventh or eighth inning relievers in the American League. It turns out he had injuries and ends up being worthless this season, but you can't predict that. But I think Dave Dombrowski actually was ahead of the game and actually paid a pretty reasonable price for Kimbrel. When you look at what the Yankees got for Chapman and then what they got for Miller, Dombrowski got more time, and he got a guy that's under at least as long control. And maybe Kimbrel's not quite as good as Chapman and Miller, but he's in that same tier. So I have to give him credit for that. But, yeah, this market was very intriguing when it comes to relievers and very costly.
Yeah, no doubt. The market for top-notch relievers was psychotic. I mean, it really was. When you think about it, I mean, it makes sense because the two teams that made the big moves, the Cubs and the Indians, the Cubs are going for it. We all know that. They haven't won in 1,000 years. If Theo Epstein can win with the Cubs, he's a god. He's just a baseball god. So he's going for it. And you know, God bless to do that. Cleveland's sort of in the same situation, right? You know, we all know they finally won a championship in basketball. Now the baseball team's feeling it too. They might very well be the best team in the American League. You know, that's really I guess you could debate about it. Assuming this injury to Danny Salazar is not anything substantial, I might give Cleveland the advantage there, especially if they could have gotten Jonathan LaCroix. They went for it too. Now, can we argue that, you know, to give up these top-name prospects for a reliever, and let's say for both teams, the regular season doesn't mean much. You only care what they're going to do in the playoffs. You know, yes, you can make an argument about that. Aroldis Chapman's a free agent at the end of the year. So I don't know if he's going to stick with the Cubs. They'll have the money, but they may not want to use it, especially with the other relievers they have on the roster. At least for Cleveland, they have Andrew Miller for 2 more years. And let's face it, if Cleveland wants, no matter what happens this year, whether they win the World Series, they don't win the World Series, they can turn right around and trade Miller in the offseason. You know, will they get back as much as they gave up? No, but they'd recoup some of it, maybe get 60-75% of what they gave up. So they can always do that, too, if it doesn't work out for them in the playoffs. So I kind of like what they did, Chris. I like teams that go for it, especially Chicago. You know, the Cubs, we all think they're the best team. Most of us think they're the best team, certainly in the National League, probably in baseball. Go for it. I mean, now with Chapman, you got Rondon, you picked up Joe Smith as well. I mean, that's pretty good for 7, 8, 9. Like, I might worry about their starting staff a little bit there, but that's pretty good. I got to hand it to the Cubs there. As for the Red Sox, I agree with you. We did think Dombrowski did pay a heavy price, but when you look at what these guys have gone for at the trade deadline, well, it was well worth it now, wasn't it? You know, and the Red Sox, you know, if they weren't going to acquire starters, they got to try and get at least a lockdown ninth inning. Hopefully with Ziegler now and Tozawa, they can lock down the eighth part of the seventh. They're going to need that as well. I was a little surprised the Red Sox didn't make more of a move yesterday. You know, not a huge move, certainly not on offense. I don't think they needed anybody there. But they're another team. But if they weren't going to give up the major prospects for sale, I'm sure they were looking at everybody else and going, oh, man, these guys really aren't much better, if any better, than what we have. You know, so maybe I'm sort of sticking with what we have here and trying to work around that. You know, I think the Red Sox will be major players in August trying to find a starting pitcher, even one that comes with a price tag that floats through waivers.
Yeah, and I've yelled at you since we started doing podcasts, probably 10 years now, that the Yankees have to add a better pitcher at the deadline. And every single year you tell me, and you're correct, but at the same time, I think I am too, is I thought the Yankees always had to add an impact starter. And every time I said that, whenever I posed the question to you, I'd always say, the Yankees need to add pitching. And your comment was, well, their pitching is fine. It's good. They don't have a spot for them. I think that's kind of the position the Red Sox had, which is the Red Sox absolutely could use a top-of-the-rotation guy so that they go in with hopefully Price pitching like a top-end guy, and then they get that number two, that Strasburg Scherzer, that Syndergaard DeGrom, that 1-2 bang that really makes you a difference-maker in the playoffs. The Red Sox absolutely could have used that, but it just wasn't out there. So I look at them sort of like I'm saying with you with the Yankees is the Red Sox don't really look that good at the back of their rotation, but the guys they could have added wouldn't have been that much better. So you pay for prospects to get maybe a Shields or pay for them to get one of these mediocre starters that a lot of the other teams ended up trading for. But you've got Eduardo Rodriguez. You've got they added Pomeranz as their number three. They've got Steven Wright as their number four right now. He's actually been one of their best pitchers all year, but he's been slumping recently, so he's probably fallen back to the four. So you look and say, well, if the Red Sox were to add another starter, how much better are they going to be than Eduardo Rodriguez? They might be a little bit, or if Eduardo Rodriguez falls apart, maybe the guy actually is better, but you're talking about a fifth starter. So I can see why the Reds didn't make a move there. You could make an argument, like you said, they didn't really need offense, but they're playing Bryce Brent in left field right now, and they're promoting Andrew Benintendi to start on Wednesday directly from Double-A. And he's a good prospect, very good prospect, to promote him directly from Double-A, kind of like they did with Mookie Betts 2 years ago. Mookie Betts did spend a little bit of time in AAA, but it was a pretty quick stop, and it was mostly because they wanted him to learn center field because he was switching from an infield to the outfield, and they needed him to get acclimated to playing in the outfield before he just did it at the major league level. So essentially, in a desperation move, they promoted Mookie Betts extremely quickly a couple of years ago. It kind of feels that way with this one. They want somebody because Bryce Brent can't play. Left field is supposed to be an offensive position, and Bryce Brent just can't really hit very much. So if the Red Sox wanted to add a Carlos Beltran, which the Yankees aren't going to trade with the Red Sox, I don't think. Those kind of deals rarely happen. But Beltran would have been a nice fit for them. Plays left field at Fenway occasionally. DH is some, I don't know. It wouldn't be a great fit, I give it a tease. But Jay Bruce could have been a fit with the Red Sox. I don't think they would want to pay the price to get him. But you could see how with their left field situation, they could have added it. But, again, it would be a luxury. It's not a necessity or a requirement. Maybe a Luke Roy. I mean, if they wanted to pay a real price, I guess Luke Roy could have been an offensive upgrade at catcher. But I don't think they saw any need to do that either. Before we get into some more details, let me ask you about that real quickly because I think one of the teams that should have made one of these smaller moves was the Detroit Tigers. They're in the hunt. They've got a good roster. They've spent money to win. They're always a team that wants to contend. Their owner, every single year, they say how Mike Ilitch, the owner, is getting older and older, and eventually he's just going to kick off. They want to win a World Series before that happens. You look at their rotation. They got Zimmerman injured. Fulmer's been fantastic. I mean, this team wouldn't even be in contention without Michael Fulmer. I think he's the Rookie of the Year in the American League. Verlander on a comeback season has been great. I think they're getting a lot more from him than they ever should have expected. But, again, with Zimmerman injured, Mike Pelfrey, and then Daniel Norris, who can't stay on the field, and whoever falls behind him, it seems like if anyone just needed innings, it was the Detroit Tigers. And not only did they not add innings, but if you look at their bullpen, K-Rod, again, has been much better than they should have ever expected, but they need some help in their bullpen either. And both of those probably could have been acquired at least a reasonable price. Again, Chris Sale wasn't probably affordable. It sounds like even Jeremy Hellickson was too expensive for teams because I would have thought he would have been moved. But it seems like the Tigers, of all teams, should have found a starter and a reliever. Everyone was trading for relievers of some sort, and yet the Tigers, it just seemed like they took the day off.
Well, they did. I mean, and that's not surprising. We've been hearing about the Tigers that they weren't going to do anything for a while, that they were going to just stand pat. You know, and that might be partly because their minor league system is not really all that stacked right now. You know, they've dealt people over the years to, you know, try and win other seasons. Maybe they didn't have enough ammunition this year. Now, you're right, they're not out of it. They are in it, but they may realize that, hey, we're just not a great team this year. You know, do we want to give up what's left of our farm system to try and go for it when there's no impact players that we can truly grab? And if that's the case, I don't mind that. You know, when you look at their prospects, I mean, you certainly do know this more than I do, but outside of Fulmer, who's with the Major League team, what else do they have? I mean, because they've gone for it over the past couple of years, they've dealt away a lot of talent. You know, so that they just didn't have the ammunition to go out and get somebody. You know, so I'm not surprised here that they didn't make a move here. I guess the only surprise would be because of the owner, Mike Ilitch. He always wants to go for it. You know, always green lights these things. Maybe I'm a little surprised there. But in the end, Chris, for me, I just don't think they had the ammunition to go out and get somebody. So I'm not surprised. Like I said, we have been hearing about this for at least a week, if not 2 weeks, that the Tigers were probably going to be very quiet.
And I think I 50% agree with that. I agree that even for a mediocre starter, the prices were high. Like, and that's why I threw Jeremy Hellickson's name out there. I wouldn't call him an ace by any stretch of the imagination. And yet it seems like the reason why he didn't – a lot of teams could have used a Hellickson. I think the Red Sox could have even used a Hellickson. But my guess is the price was so exorbitant for the sales of the world that it elevated the cost of even the Hellicksons. And so I can understand why the Tigers could definitely not afford that. Any real prospect – I mean, if Gleyber Torres goes for a two-month rental of closer – then someone even a little bit less than him in exchange for a mediocre starter, I can understand why that would be prohibitive. But a reliever, I mean, the Red Sox added this guy a bat. I don't know much about him, but those kind of guys can usually be taken for token prices. As much as there may be the minor leagues for the Tigers isn't very good, anybody could have afforded a seventh-inning lefty or something like that. I mean, I would have thought the Tigers would have at least done something small like that. I mean, they didn't even do that, but – I don't know, maybe they figured the guys they have are better than who they could have acquired, but that still surprised me a little bit. What do you think about Jonathan Lucroy? The fact that he had a no-trade clause, and when you have it, of course, you've earned the right to use it, but I'm just not in favor. Again, I would need to know the reasons why, but my initial reaction is not very positive about Lucroy refusing to go to the Indians, and then therefore benefiting what could be an eventual playoff rival in really making the Rangers maybe the biggest winner at the deadline when the Indians had a shot to possibly be. I mean, I don't think the Indians would have acquired Miller if they had gotten Lucroy, but imagine if they had. All of a sudden, everyone would be saying the Indians are the favorites, and they, without a doubt, won the deadline.
Well, when it comes to Lucroy, a couple things come in here. First, your last statement, when that Miller deal was done, the Indians thought they were still getting Lucroy. They were doing both. So I think they were surprised somewhat that LaCroix turned it down. Now, I have no problem with LaCroix doing this. None. I don't like the reason he gave. I certainly don't buy that he was thinking that he wouldn't catch it much, that John Gomes would catch over him. Yeah, I get that Gomes has a multi-year deal, but he's been terrible this year. Terrible. John LaCroix is one of the, top three catches in baseball? LaCroix was going to catch. Now, I wonder if he was thinking, well, you know what, I think Cleveland is just going to have me play for them this year and then turn around and trade me to another team. That I can see. Of course, the Cleveland being a mid-market team at best really can't afford to have two catches on the contract, even though LaCroix has got a sweetheart deal. So maybe he was worried about that, where he wouldn't have control over his next team or whatever it might be. But I was surprised because, you know, geographically, Milwaukee, Cleveland, it's only a couple of hours away. So it's not like you're going to the other side of the country. You know, so I was surprised, but I have no problem with it. But I just don't like to lie. You know, don't lie to me. You don't want to go for whatever reason. I mean, who knows? Well, we know he hates the city of Cleveland for whatever reason. You know, his family hates it, whatever it might be. It doesn't matter. You know, and here in the right, you know, Cleveland wanted Milwaukee wanted a deal, Cleveland wanted him. They should have checked to make sure. I think a lot of teams sometimes assume these players are going to say yes. You know, the only thing I would have said for LaCroix is he gambled that another deal would be able to work out. Now, maybe his agent told him, listen, okay, you don't want to go to Cleveland, fine. I think the next two teams that are going to come get you are either the Mets or the Rangers. I think we all knew those were the teams that were interested, Dodgers as well. And maybe he just preferred any of those three teams to Cleveland. So I get that. You know, that's the game he's playing. I have no problem with that. It did end up working out for him. You know, his family, his wife, I think is from Louisiana, so now he goes to Texas, obviously much closer there. So it ended up working out in the end. But bottom line is, I have no problem with him saying no, using his veto power. He earned it. It's in the contract. Hey, use it. I have no problem with that. But don't lie to me about the reason. That's what bothers me. I never bought, oh, I'm worried about that. I won't be a catcher full time. Yeah, okay. You're one of the best in the game. They're going to play Yan Gomes over you. Really.
Yeah, you make a pretty decent argument there, and I was a little bit more negative about Lucroy before you laid that out, to be honest with you. So you brought me around a little bit, because my initial reaction was negative towards him requiring the Indians to void the next year's contract, the final year of that deal. And my thinking was that was a money thing. But the way that you pointed out, you make a good point, is that maybe he did think that he would catch less if Yan Gomes was there next year. And like you said, Yan Gomes has been awful this year, but with Gomes being there long-term, Yan Gomes was a good player, at least offensively, before this season. So with him and Lucroy on the same team next season, his explanation sounds plausible and kind of limits my anger towards it. It was just purely because he wanted to hold the Indians hostage and get out as a free agent a year early. That, to me, that left a bad taste in my mouth. But as you lay it out, even though you said he's lying, I actually think that there's some sense to it, and you've kind of softened me to it a little bit, because I think that does make some sense. Though I think it would be a good thing. I can't imagine he's not going to catch at all next season in Cleveland. So you're absolutely right there. Maybe he does catch a little bit less, but I would think that would help him, not hurt him. If he played 50 games at first base and 100 at catcher, that's going to keep him healthier. It's probably going to result in a better offensive season. And it's not like teams are going to forget that he's a good catcher and think that he's a first baseman. I mean, if teams were trying to trade for Buster Posey, they're not trading for him because he's a first baseman. They're trading for him because he's one of the best defensive offensive catchers who can also play defense at the position. And Lucroy would be fitting under that same exact kind of headline. So, yeah, that doesn't make a lot of sense. I can understand why, but I would actually look at it as a positive. Yan Gomes and Lucroy next year would probably both be better off if they were playing together. On top of the fact that they could win a World Series this year, and they could be a favorite to win it next year. So, yeah, I can understand what Lucroy is saying, but I think the conclusion is wrong. I actually think that would enhance his value. The only one thing that makes some sense is, would he be traded again? I can understand why you didn't want to go through that. It wouldn't make me void the deal, but I can understand why you wouldn't want to be traded twice in 4 or 5 months. I can understand how that's annoying, but considering the opportunities that it provides as well, that wouldn't be something that – it would be something I would consider or think about, but it wouldn't be something that I would say no to, because it's not like the Indians are going to trade him to the Twins where they're not going to contend for 1 year. So if Lucroy was going to be retraded, it would probably to a good situation where he's going to catch full time on a team that's probably going to contend, like maybe the Rangers. So for me, there's really mostly positives no matter how you look at it. And so I don't like how I just didn't like how we avoided it, because I do think part of it was about money. I think he didn't want to say that, but I think part of it was he wanted to bluff them and force them and leverage them into allowing him to become a free agent a year early and not be tagged with the qualifying offer. Not that that'll probably make a big deal with him, because he'll probably be one of the top guys on the market and those guys get signed regardless, but you usually make more money and you get more interest if you're not tagged with that offer.
Of course it's about money. I mean, it's always about money with these guys, okay? And I don't blame Lucroy for it. Once again, he had the leverage. You know, he asked Cleveland to rip up the last year of the deal, but that would have made no sense for Cleveland to give up all that talent for him just for a couple of months here. Like I said, I think Cleveland with Lucroy would have done almost the exact same thing that I mentioned they could do with Miller. You know, Miller's a little different situation because at $9 million a year, I think he almost has to get moved for Cleveland. I don't think they can afford that, not with Cody Allen there too. But with Lucroy, he's only a couple of million. You know, so they don't necessarily have to get rid of him, have to move him. But I think they would have, because Yan Gomes has signed for, 3 more years? And that, you really, at their market, you can't afford to pay 2 catchers. But I agree with you. Lucroy should have looked at it. What's the worst thing that could happen? I play catcher half the season? I play first base half the season? You know, maybe he's worried that, well, if I play first base, I'm not playing catcher. When I'm a free agent in 2018, my market won't be as hot because I'm not catching anymore. I mean, I'm trying to make sense of it. But in the end, I just don't see any way for he had anything to worry about. But I'll say it again. These are human beings. Yep. If for some reason they didn't want to go to Cleveland, we don't know what the personal bias is there. If they've got problems in there, we have no idea about this. You know, but like I said, I think in the end it may have come down to he realized, or his agent realized, oh, the Mets, Texas, and L.A. are the next three teams. It's not like I'm not going to be traded at all. I'm going to be dealt. I'd rather go to one of those three teams. And if that's the case, hey, he just played the market like we would all do. You know, I know it's easy to criticize. I think I'd be a lot harsher on him if this, like, if he did it at the 4 p.m. deadline. It was either go to Cleveland or stay in Milwaukee. To me, that would be ridiculous. You know, nothing against Milwaukee, but don't you want to play for a team that has a chance to go to the World Series this year, a good chance? And as I'll say again, geographically-wise, by car, it's only about 3 hours away, give or take. So it would have been like you'll never see your family again. You would. They could just drive down, or you could go there, whatever you want to do. I would have been much harsher there. But in the end, I think this is a poker game. You know, first, okay, you want Cleveland wants me? Rip up the contract, give me more money, whatever it is. If not, then hey, I think I have a better chance of going to another team. I think I'll like the Mets better. I think I'll like the Dodgers better. I think I'll like the Rangers better. So I think they played a game of poker there. And hey, this happens all the time. You know, it ended up working out for LaCroix. So I'm not going to bash him for it. Like I said, if teams don't want players to be able to do this, don't give them a no-trade clause.
That was actually what kind of left a bad taste in my mouth, is that he wanted to go some. I would have no problem if you didn't want to go to a certain city. We hear about that up in Boston all the time when it comes to NBA players, that African-American players are resistant to come to Boston. They think that there may be some racial bias up here, and there isn't. I mean, people up here love their athletes. It doesn't matter what race or color or creed they are, but you always hear that rumor that that's one reason why some players may not want to come to Boston. There are some other reasons too, but you hear that. And I actually don't have a problem with players if that's the case. If you don't like an organization, like, for example, if I was a pitcher, there's no way I would go to Colorado. No way. If I was a prospect, I would refuse to sign if I was drafted by the Rockies, because you just can't – your career is ruined the moment you are drafted by the Colorado Rockies. So if a player wants to have a no-trade for a reason like that, I actually can understand. You don't like the city of Cleveland, okay. If you don't like the city of Boston, okay. I have no problem with that. If for some reason you hear a rumor about an organization and you just don't like it, and we've heard that over the years about how certain owners don't treat their players well or something like that, if you didn't want to go to an organization and spend all of your days working in that environment, I don't have a problem with that at all. Those are lifestyle things that I can get behind. I'm okay with that. But once it's about money and him leveraging and bluffing them and also playing the odds that if he isn't traded to the Indians, he will be traded somewhere else, that's what I don't like. That's what kind of I think was behind his decision, even though, as I said, you brought me around a little bit to maybe some legitimacy to the excuses. But for refusing to go to Cleveland for the money, that to me rubs me the wrong way and really makes me kind of dislike LaCroix for that. And I still suspect that's why he did it. I'm just I thought that it was like 95% of that before. Is maybe you have me at 80% or maybe 75% now of the reason. That's what bothers me, the money and leveraging and really screwing the Indians and really helping the Rangers in return. That to me, I really don't like that. That was really my problem with the deal.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, it's strange. I doubt we'll ever know the complete truth of what really happened here. But like I said, in the end for me, he had the veto clause. He used it. Nothing wrong with that. And I don't think we should ever, as human beings, we shouldn't ever get on someone for not wanting to go somewhere. I live in New York. I'm married. I have two kids. If my job just said, hey, we're transferring you to, you know, Washington, nice knowing you, goodbye. Well, what? You know, I have to move my house, you know, my family. You know, I get that. In the middle of the year, you know, so I understand that we should never really get on these players for it. That being said, I'm not going to be traded in my job, and I know that. Baseball players know that there's a chance they could end up getting paid big bucks to make up for that chance. So you can look at it that way, too. But I think we sort of forget the human nature of things sometimes. You know, and I don't know if LaCroix has kids or not. You know, when I think of John LaCroix's personal life, the first thing that comes to mind is that he broke his hand because a suitcase fell on him. So that's the first thing that comes to mind there. But I think we forget about this sometimes. That, you know, these players all have personal lives, and they may not want to uproot their kids, uproot their wife. Maybe the wife says, hey, if you leave Milwaukee, I'm leaving you. You know, we never know what's going on here. So, like I said, I'm not going to bash him for it. I just didn't like the excuse he gave. That's it.
What was the biggest surprise of not just the trade deadline day, but any of the trades in the last couple of weeks. What one trade kind of struck you or shocked you the most?
I don't know if any trade I would say shocked me the most. I think the biggest surprise was more teams not acquiring a starting pitcher. For all the teams in the American League that needed one, the Rangers yesterday. You know, I'm acquiring Carlos Beltran. All right, fine and good. You didn't need another bat. Right? You needed a starting pitcher. You know, how does Joey Gallo not go to get you that starting pitcher? But you acquire two bats. You get LaCroix. You get Carlos Beltran. Are you going to try and win a lot of these games, you know, 7-6? I know Cole Hamels and Yu Darvish are a nice start, but after that, you have nothing left. You know, the bullpen is okay. It's not great. So I worry about that. You really don't know what you're going to get out of Darvish. You know, coming back from TJ, already been put back on the DL once. You don't know if he's going to last through October. You just don't know. So I think that was one of the biggest surprises for me is these teams just not getting it. One trade that I guess I didn't understand was the Twins and Angels, two teams that are out of it, Nolasco and Meyer for Hector Santiago and minor league, a Buzznet, something like that. That was a little shocking, to say the least. Okay, why? Why is this happening? You know, two teams that really had nothing to go for. Liriano going to Toronto? I mean, that was almost humorous. And Pittsburgh ships off two prospects as well. Not great prospects, but guys who are thinking to be major leaguers. Now, I get it. Pittsburgh really is trying to save some money here. And, you know, he who fights and runs away lives to fight another day. I get it. But why would Toronto want Liriano and pay that money? He's getting crushed in the National League Central. What's he going to do in the American League East? And for them to now say they're almost definitely going with Sanchez in the bullpen, I don't really get this. I just don't. You don't get a chance to win every day. Think of the Toronto Blue Jays. You don't get a chance to win every day. You know, Blue Jays came out of a huge drought last year by winning the East. This year is really their window is closed after this year. Jose Bautista, Edwin Encarnacion, both free agents. They're not both coming back. They may both be gone. So this is your year. You're going to close Sanchez. There's no medical proof that shutting these guys down will help them long-term, will solve arm injuries. We think it will, but there's no proof. But either way, you don't get a chance to win. You look at Sanchez's numbers, everything is trending normal. His velocity's up. He's still doing all his midweek work. He's not having any problems. He's not showing any signs of being tired. Yet you're going to shut him down in August and move him to the bullpen? I mean, and you're in a race. You don't have an 8-game lead here. We all figured, we were talking about it for weeks, that really whichever team, Boston, Toronto, Baltimore, made the best deal at the deadline, would probably win the division. None of these teams made a great deal. You know, and now you're going to shut down your best pitcher? In my mind, you're giving up. All right, we'll play for next year. But you don't have a next year without Bautista and Encarnacion. The offense won't be as good, and you'll be in the same spot. You're still going to need another starting pitcher. This is Strasburg all over again. You know, you're playing for the future when your future is now.
Yeah, I mean, their worst trade deadline deal may be to transition Aaron Sanchez to the bullpen. That might, instead of helping them, may actually be the reason they lose. I 100% agree with you there. And it's only about money, and that's really what the Jays did. I can see how the Blue Jays, in exchange for cash, because they didn't give up any talent, Drew Hutchinson is no loss for them. But if Liriano can somehow figure it out, and again, I think that's really an if, but I mean, I guess take a shot. Why not take a whirl? Liriano still throws the ball well. He still strikes out a lot of batters. He just has no command at all, and he's leading baseball in walks. So that's why he's giving up a fair amount of home runs, which tells me the command isn't there. So I don't think the Jays should think they're going to turn around. Usually the Pirates are the team that turn pitchers around, and then other teams fleece them, like, for example, the Jays. The Pirates turned J. Hey Happ's career around last season, and then the Jays went out and signed him to a 3-year deal this past offseason. And that happens with the Pirates guys every single year. So the fact that they couldn't turn Liriano around is probably even more of a sign that the Jays won't be able to either. But you can understand why they take a shot. Because if they are determined, and I agree with you, it's kind of irrational and there's no evidence or proof to justify it. But if they believe and they commit to saving Sanchez's arm and they don't want to do the workload on him, if Liriano can come in and be anything close to Sanchez, and again, I agree with you 100%, it's very unlikely that he turns it around just because he changes laundry. To me, that's crazy. But if it does, they get the best of both worlds. They get an impact guy in Liriano who's back to pitching well, and they can put Sanchez in the bullpen where he can also dominate and pitch less innings and pitch less often. I can understand where they would love that to work out. But I agree with you that it's unlikely to work out. So what we'll probably see 3 weeks from now, and hopefully for the Jays fans it won't sink their chances at the playoffs, is that Liriano goes out there and has two or three bad starts, and they transition Sanchez back into the rotation. And hopefully for them it won't be too late, and hopefully it doesn't stagger Sanchez, because all of a sudden you go from starter to reliever and then back to starter again. I mean, that could hurt Sanchez, maybe not injury-wise, but it could actually impact his performance. So they are taking a risk there. The other side of that deal, just to kind of to wrap it up here, Harold Ramirez and Reese McGuire are pretty good prospects. They're not elite guys, and they're not going to probably ever be all-stars. But Harold Ramirez has some pretty good talent. He hasn't become what they thought he might be. So at one time, he was looked as a full-time quality outfielding prospect. He's taken longer than he was supposed to, and he's not quite as good as they would hope. And maybe there's still potential for him to get back to those expectations. But there's a little bit of a little bit of the glow is off the rose there. So, but he's still a pretty talented athlete with some potential there. And if they are going to lose Encarnacion and Bautista, maybe Ramirez eventually finds a spot in the outfield somewhere. And Reese McGuire is more of a bat. They list him still as a catcher, but I don't know if he can ever defensively handle the position. But he's a pretty – the question really is he would be a really good offensive catcher, but he may be a mediocre offensive, say, outfielder or first base. So he's kind of a tweener there. But he could also be a major league player of some sort. So – and essentially, they bought Harold Ramirez and they bought Reese McGuire with the hopes that they become players. And again, it's an intriguing kind of weird deal, and I was kind of caught off guard by it as well. I would have liked to have seen a team like the Red Sox take a chance on Liriano, because they, at number five, if Liriano could turn things around, that's a nice spot. With the Jays doing it in order to put Sanchez in the bullpen, I don't like that quite as much. But it caught me a little off guard that in the middle of all these deals and all the rumors about where Luke Roy was going, to see Liriano traded to the Jays kind of at the last minute, that caught me a little bit off guard as well. I was surprised and agreed with you about the Twins. The Twins-Angels deal was a blip in an otherwise contender-focused analysis and rumored afternoon, and all of a sudden these two mediocre pitchers get swapped by teams fighting for the number one overall amateur draft pick. So that was definitely a weird move as well. I would just say about Alec Myers, very talented pitcher that the Twins could never turn into a starter. He's like 6'10", and tall prospects usually have a hard time getting things together and bringing their mechanics all into sync so that they can command the ball well enough to become an effective starter. And the Twins just were never able to do that with Alec Myers. I'm not saying that the Angels can do that, but you look at the potential and say, I'd like to take a chance on that. I could see why the Angels would like to. And their system is so bad that Myers is probably one of their best two or three prospects already. So they take a prospect that the Twins are probably giving up on, and he immediately becomes one of the Angels' four or five best prospects in their system. So that's how desperate the Angels are, and I could see why they would really want to take a chance. I wouldn't mind either. I actually have Alec Myers in a couple of my Dynasty leagues because I'm hoping that one day he figures it out. I'm not expecting it to happen, but I'm kind of hoping that maybe somehow he does. And some guys do figure out on occasion once in a while. Another deal that took me by surprise, and it was interesting, the Giants traded their starting third baseman, Matt Duffy, and a couple of prospects. I don't know much about Michael Santos, I got to be honest, but Lucius Fox was an international signing that was supposed to be a pretty talented guy. But they give away a starting player from the major leagues, which is very surprising, to add Matt Moore, who I've always liked the arm, but he's never really become the pitcher that everyone thought he might be. And again, he had Tommy John surgery, so he was sidelined by that. So I'm sure he was pitching with some injuries before we realized it. Then he missed all that time because of TJ. So maybe that's why Matt Moore has been kind of disappointing for us. But that caught me a little off guard as well. You got Matt Cain. You've got Jake Peavy. Not that they're great pitchers. They add yet another arm in there. That one was – I'm not stunned, but if Matt Moore was going to move, I would have thought someone else, even like a Tigers or even like Red Sox, though the Rays are going to trade the division probably. But I was a little surprised that Matt Moore went to the Giants. We heard that he might go somewhere, but I was a little surprised that he went to the Giants and that a team was willing to give a major league player in order to do that. Because usually teams, especially in contention, and the A's did this a few years ago with John Lester and the Yennis Suspedes trade, and it really kind of destroyed that team. You don't usually see guys from the major league roster on contenders being traded for additional help, and in this case, more of a luxury than a need.
Yeah, I agree with you. The fact that it is strange at the trade deadline for a team in it to deal a piece you know, on the major league roster, a good piece. Now, I'm not talking a 24th, 25th man on the roster, but a good piece. You know, you're starting third base in there. So that actually was a little bit of a surprise. But they did acquire Nunez. You know, Eduardo Nunez with Twins last week, so now he could slide over there if necessary, which I'm assuming it will be. So maybe that was their thinking there. We needed another pitcher. We like Duffy, but we don't see him as being a long-term answer, whatever it might be. And Tampa Bay really, really wanted Duffy from everything we're hearing. You know, they would may not have done the deal without Duffy being included. The Giants don't have an incredibly strong system as far as top prospects. You know, it seems to me when you look at their system, they have a lot of good prospects, but nobody at the top. There's a lot of guys in that that might develop, but aren't quite there yet. Good prospects, not great ones. So maybe that was the thinking there as well. Tampa is looking for someone that can solve that shortstop position, which is Duffy's natural position, so he'll get a shot there. So I can see this deal for both sides. You know, we knew that Tampa was going to trade one of their big three. Yeah, you know, what they consider their big three anyway. Chris Archer, Jake Odorizzi, and Matt Moore. They seem to want to move Moore first before Odorizzi. Archer, they would have had to be knocked over the deal. But they seem to they liked Odorizzi a little bit more than Moore. And so that's what happened there. You know, heard that Moore was also interested in probably going to the Dodgers and some other teams. And I might wonder if they could have done better waiting in the offseason, you know, for Matt Moore. I'm surprised they couldn't get more as far as prospects back in return. Now, with all these teams that needed starting pitching help, makes you wonder if these teams just don't look at Moore as anything special anymore, that he's just not going to be that kind of player. So in the end, Chris, I am surprised, but this may be why Nunez was acquired last week.
Yeah, Nunez is a pretty bad defensive player. For the Giants to be willing to settle for him at third base is interesting. And as I said, Moore's more of a luxury, but they also have some control with him. So I like the addition for the future, but it's intriguing how it impacts their current situation. I've always liked Nunez. Even when he was a Yankee, we used to talk about him. I've always liked Nunez's physical talent, but defensively he's just always made it extremely difficult to put him out there on a regular basis. It'll be interesting to see how he fits. The Giants seem to always get the most out of their players. So maybe they find a way to inject some fundamental ability on defense to Nunez, and all of a sudden he becomes a viable third baseman. I don't know. You can testify to his defensive limitations at third base or anywhere else, but I like him as the athlete, and he's having a very nice year this year. We're talking Major League Baseball trade deadline, and we're going to start talking fantasy baseball right now with George Kurtz, staff writer from rotoexperts.com. I am your host, Chris Mitchell. This is a podcast to be named later. If you want to follow us on Twitter, it's at CJMitch73 for me. It's at George Kurtz for George. And, George, let's get into the fantasy real quickly. Since we were talking about Matt Duffy, I don't think he profiles all that well as a fantasy third baseman, but like you said, it looks like he's going to be the shortstop. He's out for injury right now, but they're expecting him to be back in the next couple weeks or so. He had double-digit homers and double-digit steals last year. I think it was 12 home runs and 17 stolen bases. So not exactly huge numbers, but yet it's still two categories at the shortstop position. I would have to assume his fantasy value increases moving from third to short. But does he all of a sudden become a meaningful fantasy guy, or does he just increase his value without it actually being really enough of an impact to get excited?
I'm going to go with option two there. His value certainly increases going to shortstop, but he's not going to be compared to the big guys we have. He's not Bogart, Story, Russell, Lindor. I know I left some people out there, but he's not one of those guys. You know, he's not going to be in that top tier. So, but once again, I think he'll be bottom top 10. You know, 8 to 10, 8 to 12 range, somewhere around there. So he'll have value. He could certainly hit. He goes from, you know, San Fran, pitches ballpark, to Tampa Bay, which is also a pitcher's ballpark, does play on turf. So maybe that helps out the little some more hits there coming. Park's a little bit smaller, so maybe another home run or two, a couple of clicks. But when does he figure out the American League? You know, that's one thing good about this year. You know, this way he gets to get adjusted to the league this year. So by next year when we're drafting again, we'll have a better idea of what he can do. I said, I don't see him making a big jump here, Chris, where all of a sudden he's like, oh, my God, he's going to be great. I don't see that. But for guys who are not able to get the Carlos Correa types, I think he's the other guy I left out there, he'll be a nice fallback option in the later rounds. You know, I think he'll be a solid player. But once again, not going to be a star.
The Pirates kind of stunned me a little bit. And finances always play a role in what the Pirates do. They're one of the few teams that are still meaningfully impacted by money. And they've drafted and developed so well, and they've had some really high picks. So they deserve credit for how well they've done, but they also, you got to put out there that they've had some pretty high picks. Gerrit Cole was a top-tier pick. Andrew McCutchen was a top-tier pick. So they've really had some pretty high picks in there. But nonetheless, I was surprised to see Melanson move. And then you see Liriano move. And Liriano's pitching so poorly, I see why you would move on from him. I mean, he was terrible. He was unstartable in fantasy purposes for me. I released him a couple of years ago, and it hurts me to do that because I've been a Liriano guy since he was a prospect with the Twins, back when he came in as a rookie and was insanely good. Then he ended up having Tommy John surgery, and then he came back and ended up having some good years. I mean, I've been following Liriano since before I can even remember, but he's been awful this year. The Pirates made some really interesting sideways moves here. Let's go with them, and let's start with Liriano. We knew that the Jays wanted to move Sanchez to the bullpen. So as much as a Liriano trade to Toronto could have impacted one of the lesser pitchers, it probably doesn't now because Sanchez will just plop out and Liriano will move in. So there's probably not a large impact fantasy-wise, I would suspect, in Toronto. If I'm wrong, by all means, interject your thoughts there. But on the Pirates, they've got Jeff Locke, who's been terrible. They've got Ryan Vogelsong, I guess, coming back. Who knows what he can be. They've got Talion back now. Glasnow possibly will be back. It looks like he's on the DL right now, but assuming that's not significant, maybe he's back in the next 2 or 3 weeks. What's the impact of Liriano on the starting rotation of the Pirates?
Well, he has been terrible, right? He was terrible. So I guess in that case, they had nothing to lose here. I have no problem with them dealing Liriano. I just think they pretty much gave two prospects away as well, just to save that money. It bothers me a little bit. But like I said, it could be a case of, you know, he who fights and runs away lives to fight another day. At $17 million, they say, which for Pittsburgh is substantial. So that may be what they're looking at here. They also traded Jonathan Neese, so they got rid of another possible starter, acquired Ivan Nova, you know, which who knows what's going to happen. Nova has some talent, but hasn't been able to figure it out yet. So I don't mind them, as far as trading Liriano is concerned. I don't think they had much to lose there. I just didn't like the rest of the deal. I just thought it was strange. You know, I think they definitely thought it was strange. Now, what they're probably thinking is, all right, we got Gerrit Cole. We think Nova's going to make a good transition to the National League. We like his stuff. You got Talion. Glasnow will be back, we hope, in about a week. You know, so then we'll piece it together with your number five starter after that. Listen, they may also, Chris, this may come down to where they realize, you know what, we're not waving the white flag, but Cubs are better than we are. Cardinals are better than we are. Nationals are better than we are. We're not better than these teams. This is not our year. You know, we're going to reload. We can sell it to the fans that way. We're still fighting for this year. We might even get in a wild card. If you look at their schedule, the Pirates have an easy schedule. So they'd be looking at that too. But deep down, we know we're playing for next year. We're going to save that $17 million. That will allow us to make another move, acquire a better starting pitcher. You know, so I wonder if that's it too. I also wonder, if the Pirates will be one of these teams, now that they've saved this money with Liriano, could they be looking at an August acquisition of a player that gets their waivers? Yeah, I don't know about James Shields. That still may be too high a price for them. But, you know, they can find somebody else. Because right now, really, I mean, even if Glasnow comes back and he's healthy, you still got Jeff Locke. I mean, that's a problem. You know, so I agree with you. It's curious, but in the end, I think this is what small markets have to do. We've seen Tampa Bay do similar things in their past. And you got to do what you got to do, especially your team, both now and in the future. I have no problem dealing with Liriano. I just didn't like the fact that they gave away two prospects along with it to get Toronto to eat that money.
Yeah, I can understand why the Pirates did it. And while I think both of those prospects are actually pretty decent, they're not just throwaway nobodies. That was a little bit a lot to give. But like you said, $17 million is two or maybe three additions to the Pirates team next year. In free agency, in a market that will probably be deep with affordable options. There's not a lot of high-end guys in next year's free agent pool, but there might be a lot of low-level kind of guys you can add. So that $17 million could make a pretty reasonable impact on what the Pirates do in the offseason. And so I can understand why they gave up. They didn't give up ace prospects, but they gave up guys that were a little bit better than I would normally expect. The Mark Melanson deal was strange to me. I'm all for a team who feels like they need to make those kinds of moves to do it. So if you're going to take advantage of a seller's market like this reliever market was, them trading Melanson, I have no problem with that as a philosophy. I didn't like the prospects they got in return, and they actually had to pay a little bit of Melanson's money. That's what struck me as strange from a trade perspective. Let me ask you from the fantasy perspective. One, with Papelbon's struggles, he's a very temperamental guy. He's not going to like being replaced. And what do you think of Tony Watson as the closer? Is he going to be the closer? And what do you think of him in Pittsburgh?
I actually thought this was a pretty shrewd move by Pittsburgh. Yeah, the reason is this. Watson, I know his numbers look good, but he's not a lights-out closer. His, if you look at his numbers, his velocity is going down, sending in the wrong direction. And if I'm Washington, is he really the guy you want in, you know, Game 7 of the playoffs? You know, and it's closing out that ninth inning, a one-run lead. I don't know. But like I said, his numbers are great. You look at his ERA, it's 1.51, 2.23, 1.9, 1.39. It's always great. Yeah, so he gets the job done. But I think I'd rather have a top-notch guy there, a guy who I think can blow people away. Blanche is going to put that ball in play. You know, so I wonder how that's going to work out in the playoffs. Not worried about Papelbon. I was. I think I wrote somewhere, I forget where, or maybe even said it on the radio, that I think the most curious thing about this is going to be how would Papelbon accept it? You know, what Boutre is going to get overturned. He's going to go ballistic. He didn't. He actually handled it very well. He understood. So good for him. Maybe some maturity there. Maybe he's grown up a little bit. If you're Papelbon, it's hard to defend. You were awful, and you were just awful. So we knew this was happening. I'm a little surprised Watson did. Like I said, they had the process to go out and get a Miller, go out and get a Chapman. You know, so I think they may regret this in the end of this season. That once again, Washington is a team that plays for the long haul, which I find kind of strange. We mentioned the Strasburg situation earlier where they shut him down. It might have cost them a chance to go deep in the playoffs or even a World Series run. Now, this year, they don't acquire a top-notch closer. You know, it could end up costing them again. It's great to be really good in the regular season, but flags fly forever. In fantasy and in reality, you know, you may want to go for it, you know, and give up what it would require to get these guys so you know you're going to have that ninth inning locked down. But like I said, for the Pirates, I thought this was a shrewd move. I thought they saw the writing on the wall, save some money. They got Felipe Rivero in the back of the deal, another hard-throwing reliever as well. I don't mind. I'm a little surprised that Pittsburgh couldn't have gotten more back. You know, I thought with the price we saw, Melanson wasn't going to bring back the price that Miller or Chapman bring back. But I thought he could have brought back a little bit more, but they traded him really quick. As soon as we heard he was on the market, he was off the market. You know, he was dealt. So I was a little bit surprised by that. And I was a little bit surprised they couldn't get back more from Washington because, you know, the pressure was on the Nationals. After they took Papelbon out of the save opportunity last Thursday, we all knew they were going to make a move, right? We all knew that. So I was surprised they couldn't get back, you know, squeak out a little bit more. I'm not talking Trey Turner or Giolito, but I was always surprised they couldn't get back a little bit more from the Nationals.
Yeah, and I was on a show yesterday, and a lot of the guys that I was on the show with forgot that Melanson was traded to the Nationals. They were complaining the Nationals didn't make any moves and that they stood pat at the deadline. And I was like, guys, they added the third best reliever that was eventually traded in at the deadline. And you know closers better than I do. You do the closer report over at rotoexperts.com every week. So you know the nuances of these relievers a lot better than I do. So I'll step back to your expertise over my own, and that pains me. Like I say, it pains me to ever push back on my opinion for someone else's. But you know these guys better than I do. So I'll at least adhere to your opinion and give it a little bit more respect than my own. But I do look at the numbers, and I say, wow, Melanson's actually been really good. It almost feels like he's not getting the respect that he deserves. The points you make are interesting and getting inside of it, sort of not even inside the numbers, inside the reality, because that does happen sometimes, especially with relievers. The sample sizes are always small, but he's had 3 years of really good numbers. And while his strikeout rate is nowhere near the elite guys, and I would never argue that Melanson is as Miller or Chapman. Those two guys are a tier by themselves. But then when you look at the next tier, I'd look at Melanson as one of the better ones. So if you take away the elite relievers either that didn't move or the two that did, and then you start that next tier, I look at Melanson purely on the numbers as being one of the better guys. I mean, he doesn't stand way apart above and beyond all that second tier, but I think he respectfully belongs right amongst them all. And again, that's going by the numbers, not going by the fact like you were talking about with the velocity and all those things. And the strikeout numbers aren't bad. You see a guy like Brad Ziegler, and he was closing in Arizona just fine, and he didn't strike out anybody. It's not like Melanson doesn't strike out anybody. He just doesn't wow you. And like you said, he doesn't have the 98-mile-an-hour velocity that a lot of these other guys have. But just purely on the numbers, he looks like one of the better second-tier guys. And to your last point, they really Taylor Hearn is not an impact prospect. If he was, I would be, you know, analyzing him. I'm writing an article for Roto Experts right now talking about the fantasy impact of all of the prospects that matter in the trade deadline moves here. I'm not probably going to mention Taylor Hearn. I'm going to go back and research him and look at some of the profiles that have been written about him. And if I see something that's impressive, I'll throw him in there and I'll analyze him. But my opinion right now is that Taylor Hearn isn't really much of a fantasy prospect. So they gave away a closer, and they even threw in some cash. And Rivero, maybe he can be the next Molossi for the next 3 years. Maybe they saw him as that. And if that's the case, then I would change my opinion a year from now. But it just looked like they kind of gave him away in a market which was a seller's market. I would have thought he could have brought back more. Not again, like I agree with you. He's not bringing back a Torres. He's not bringing back those types of guys. He's not bringing Clint Frazier to Pittsburgh. But to me, they didn't really get anything for him. And to me, that was a little bit of a surprise. let me ask you about – go ahead. I'm sorry. I cut you off.
Okay. I'm good. Go ahead.
I was going to move on to the Andrew Krasner trade, which I found interesting. First – this is it's not unprecedented, but it's definitely, let's put it, unique. Colin Ree was traded from the Padres to the Marlins, and if you listen to John Morosi on MLB Network or one of the other analysts, Tom Verducci, your boy up there in New York, Joel Sherman, what's the name, Drake? He talked about how Marlins, really, the guy that they wanted in this deal was Colin Ree because they thought he was underappreciated and that they were looking at the advanced metrics and they thought Ree had a lot coming, that he was getting better and better. So he was kind of a guy that they were trying to acquire on the come here a little bit, and that he was actually the guy that the Marlins wanted most that the Marlins wanted most in this Padres trade. He gets traded over to the Marlins with Andrew Kashner. He goes out and pitches, and he gets injured in the first three innings of his start for the Marlins. So as a kind of a – almost like a good guy kind of favor, the Padres take him back. They say, okay, it's not that we were dishonest with you. We're not admitting that we duped you. But just in good faith, as a good gesture of us being gentlemanly, we'll take Colin Ree back. And so then the trade was reworked. Have you ever heard anything like that? We've seen guys get injured. It happened actually with the Red Sox about 15 to 20 years ago. A little bit of a unique situation, no?
Well, I think what people need to remember here is that the Padres were under no obligation to take back Ree. In Major Baseball, it's buyer beware. Once that trade is made, you know, if the guy can come back to you in parts, it doesn't matter. You know, so... I think I tell you something about maybe the integrity of the Padres to do this, to take him back. We didn't realize he was hurt. My art bad. We'll take him back. Good for them. I really tell you something about how Preller operates there. He just said, hey, you know, I don't care. You took him and he's your problem now. And keep in mind, you know, I forget the name of the player now, but another deal that Miami and the Padres made, it was a player Miami gave to San Diego that ended up getting TJ surgery. You didn't hear Preller complain. So he could have said, hey, well, now we're even. You know, so I'm a little surprised that he took him back. So it was kind of funny. You don't see it all that often. I hated the deal at first, you know, when Luis Castillo was included in this. Now that Castillo's coming back, I don't mind it as much. You know, I think it really comes down to what you feel about Kashner. I mean, we've been waiting for this guy for years, it seems like. I know he's the former Red Sox. And, yeah, we were just waiting to be that, I don't want to say top-notch, but reliable starter. And he's not even that. So for Miami, they were desperate for a starting pitcher. They're probably desperate for one now again, now that they lost Ray. So interesting, but if you can't pitch at San Diego, I know Petco Park is not quite the pitcher's park it used to be. It's a little bit more hitter-friendly. Miami is probably the most pitcher-friendly park on earth. So perhaps that'll help his numbers out somewhat. So I think in some ways, good for Miami. I think Lurie wants to get into the playoffs somehow, you know, in that the new stadium and all that, get some good publicity there. I don't think it's enough, though. I think they really need to acquire another starting pitcher, and probably they need to acquire a better starting pitcher, you know, but I just don't think that's out there either.
What's the fantasy impact of Kashner going from, like you said, a pitcher's park in San Diego to a pitcher's park with the Marlins? He goes from a non-contender to the Marlins are a contender. I'm not buying into them as a wild-card team, but at least for now they are. Any fantasy impact? Kashner has pitched a little bit better recently, but does the change in laundry really make a fantasy matter to you?
Sure. Marlins are in it, so I think it does help your fantasy team. If I own Kashner, I'm happier that he's with Miami than he was with San Diego. Better chance for a win, team's in it, better ballpark for pitchers, but it's a slight increase. It's not like, oh, my God, I got to go up to your cashier now because I get waiver wire. No, but he's now, I think he's serviceable, somebody you can do some matchup types. Someone to keep an eye on, you know, that your scout team, if you're using one of those sites that have that, because he might end up being pretty decent. He does have the talent. Maybe he just needed a change of scenery. Maybe all of this would help. Maybe the pennant race will wake him up a little bit to chase for a while. But in the end, okay, you know, if I'm in a league and I, you know, oh, Chris Mitchell got cashed, they're over me. Ah, okay, good luck.
Getting back to the Matt Moore trade, we didn't really look at him all that from the Matt Moore perspective. They've got Matt Cain, Jake Peavy, and Matt Moore. Now, normally I think you would have thought that Matt Moore is a lock to start, and I think that's probably the case. But I want to get your opinion on that. Matt Cain is not really pitching all that well, and if he pitches horribly, then, of course, he's out of the rotation. But if Peavy and Cain pitch respectively, and Moore keeps pitching just respectively, because while I love Matt Moore's arm and I loved his stuff pre-TJ, it's not like he's pitching great. The Giants didn't acquire an ace here, at least the way he's been throwing. Is Moore guaranteed to be a starter the rest of the way, or is there a little bit of caution about just exactly what role he has going forward?
No, I think Moore's starting. Matt Cain's been awful. All right, he's just been awful, and Peavy hasn't been really all that much better. I think Matt Moore was acquired to start, not to be in the bullpen as a lefty reliever. Now, if I own Matt Moore, I'm quite confident that he's starting here. And really, you know, David Gay, the pitching coach, they're very good at what they do there. They do turn some things around there. We know it's a great ballpark for pitchers. So is Tropicana Field, so. But at least he gets out of the American League East, not based on those lineups anymore. I think this is good for Matt Moore. Once again, not, oh, my God, he's going to win me a fantasy championship. Not that kind of guy. But I think it's a good move for him. I think it moves him up a tick or two in my rankings, you know, where before maybe he was top 50, now he's top 40.
And four guys that are kind of middle of the road, maybe viable in deep leagues. I'm in a 20-team dynasty keeper league, and so I have some really bad players in my offense. So a Brandon Guyer and a Steve Pierce would actually be viable for me in that league. But I would say in standard leagues, it's probably a reach. But four guys that move that I want to get you a quick opinion. Brandon Guyer, Steve Pierce, Jonathan Neath back to the Mets, and Ivan Nova to the Pirates, who you touched on a little bit before. Do these guys become fantasy relevant, or do they get significant boosts or negatives with their changes of scenery? What's the quick snapshot of how the impact is there?
That guy I'm not worried about. That's it. In your type of league, 20-team league, sure, he's probably worth a claim, see what happens there. Steve Pierce, to me, is much more interesting, but we don't know the role that Baltimore's going to use him. Showalter likes him. He's a former Oriole. He can be moved around, but is there a spot for him? Is he going to play him every day in left field? You know, I need to see that. Other than that, where's he going to play? You know, everything else is pretty much clogged up with batters there. So I need to see that he's going to play every day. If he plays every day, then he's valuable. I like the fact that he has all the position flexibility. He's having a good year hitting, and he was doing this in Tampa. Now you go to Camden. You know, much better hit his ballpark there. He knows the American League East. It was in the East. So I'm very interested in Pierce, but the big if is he going to play every day? Or is it this super utility guy that Showalter's going to use that plays 3-4 games a week? That would be frustrating.
Yeah, and they've got a lot of guys like that. A lot of guys on that team that in deep leagues, like I said, my 20-team dynasty type of situations where there are some guys that are, you know, stretch viable, and the Orioles have a few of those guys. Let me ask you about Carlos Beltran having a very good season. If people don't realize it, he's having a really good season with the Yankees, especially at his age. But he moves to Texas, and I think the automatic assumption is, wow, that Rangers lineup, Beltran goes there. The Rangers are only 13th in offense and runs scored in the month of July. This is an offense that's been effective and even solid, but not one of the best. And so I'm curious, he does go from New York, who's a borderline contender, I guess you would say, maybe borderline being polite. But how big of an impact is Beltran leaving an offense that hasn't been all that great? Like I said, the Rangers are tied for 13th in July, while you look at the Yankees and they are 23rd in July in runs scored. So definitely a boost. But when you look at it, I'm just going to run the numbers here real quickly. The Texas Rangers scored 110 runs, while the Yankees scored 97. So we're talking about 13 runs in a month. So that's a run every other day, give or take. Is it a significant impact that Beltran leaves the Yankees offense that we look at as mediocre to go to a Rangers team who I think people think is better than it actually is?
No, I don't think Beltran's value changes at all. He was the Yankees' offense, by the way. It wasn't like he was part. He was the Yankees' offense, having a great year, switch hitter, but it doesn't change any. I guess you could say, yeah, when he bats right-handed, you know, he won't be hitting at the Death Valley anymore. You know, Bull does fly out of Texas all over the place, so a slight advantage. But wherever you had Beltran before is where he is now. The line, you mentioned, the Texas line wasn't great. It's good. It's certainly not going to get any worse with Beltran and LaCroix. But his value doesn't change any to me. This is mainly a major league deal that helps the Texas lineup overall. Fantasy-wise, though, Beltran, his value, actually, he may go up a tick or two, but not very much. I think he's going to have he'll be great with Texas. I don't think he'll have any problems, but his value doesn't change.
John Rucker, I assume that this excites a lot of fantasy owners in keeper leagues. I don't know if it drastically changes his value in yearlies, but if it does, by all means, give me your 2 cents there. But a smaller part of that deal that didn't get a lot of hype, but Jeremy Jeffress also goes to the Rangers, a nice little bullpen arm. Who's closing in Milwaukee now that Jeffress is gone?
Okay, a couple of things. We'll talk about the closers first. Tyler Thornburg is probably going to close in Milwaukee. Don't know if they care. Not much to see here. I mean, LaCroix is gone. Ryan Braun's still dealing with a side injury. Wins are going to be few and far between for the Brewers here. But it'll be Thornburg. If you're desperate, that's where you want to get there. It does look like Dyson's going to continue to close for Texas. So Dyson owners don't have to panic yet. But the leash just got shorter. He's been pitching fine, so I really wouldn't panic all that much. But kind of thing, when he blows a save or two, you know, Jeffress, who once again doesn't have a history of closing either. But, you know, they could make that move if they so want to. Still, in my mind, Texas doesn't have a lockdown close. These guys are all closers, but nowhere near top tier. As for LaCroix, you know, I could play devil's advocate here. You know, the ballpark, Miller Park was a great ballpark to hit in. All right, so I don't know if the ballpark factor changes all that much here. His first job with the Rangers is getting to know that pitching staff. As a catcher, that's his first job. He's going to a new league. That can be a problem. We've seen that before with hitters, learning new pitchers, overstudying you have to do, you know, getting comfortable with the new surroundings. So, you know, if I'm a John LaCroix owner, I probably want them to stay in Milwaukee. You know, maybe long-term next year, that doesn't bother me as much. But this year, players who get traded mid-year, it doesn't always work out. So much goes on here. Once again, these guys are human beings. Lots of changing. Maybe worrying about what his kids are doing, what his wife's up to, selling the house, moving. You know, I probably would have been happier as a John LaCroix owner with him staying in Milwaukee. That being said, as you well know, I don't draft catchers early, so I don't have LaCroix in any team. I don't have to worry about this. But that'd be my one little worry there, Chris. I think he'll be fine. It certainly lengthens that lineup. But like I said, I'm not – oh, the guy's in Texas. He's got to hit great now. And Milwaukee was just as good a place to hit.
Rich Hill and Josh Reddick both go to the Dodgers. Looks like Yasiel Puig, who hopefully for your benefit you weren't starting anyway, but he would be impacted, I guess, by the acquisition of Reddick. But what are your thoughts? If Rich Hill can ever get on the bump, this blister issue is kind of becoming frustrating. But what's the fantasy impact of Rich Hill and Josh Reddick going to the Dodgers?
Well, this is the blister from hell, right? I mean, this blister has been going on for a month now. Good for the Oakland. He was still able to get a very good, what I thought was a pretty solid return for Rich Hill and Josh Reddick, for that matter. As for Hill, once again, ballpark factor is negligible. Can't hit in Oakland, can't really hit in Dodger Stadium, so it's good pitchers, ballparks. We don't know when he's going to pitch, though. And the Dodgers have to wait to make sure this blister is healed, though, so we've got to keep seeing what we've been seeing. He's going to be scheduled to start, throw a bullpen, and it's not healed, he can't pitch. I'm also going to wonder, is his first outing out there, what if that blister opens up again? You know, it starts developing again. You know, where's the pickle juice, whatever they like to use to get rid of these things? So you have to be concerned somewhat. That being said, he's not on your waiver wire anyway. But right now, he's a wait-and-see guy. I don't want to start him, Chris, in my first week or first start when he actually is going to start to L.A. And not unless it's a two-start week. If it's a one-start week, he's a wait-and-see guy to me. I want to make sure he can get through that outing first rather than, he was only able to last two innings before the blister redeveloped. He's going to be a wait-and-see guy for me. Josh Reddick, is there going to be a platoon here? You know, I wonder if this is going to come on here. We know Reddick can hit somewhat, but he's got the opposite problem of Hill. He goes to the same kind of ballpark. It's a pitcher's ballpark, not a hitter's one. I do wonder if there'll be a platoon of some sort. Dodgers have a lot of right-handed batters that could platoon with him. So we'll wait to see if this is out here. And the power hasn't been there this year. That's another concern. I only have 8 home runs. I know he's been hurt, and we had the thumb injury. But thumb injuries also bother me. Thumb, hand, wrist, always bother me for batters because they got to grip that bat and be able to grip it and rip it. And maybe he can't do that right now.
Jay Bruce goes to the Mets. He goes from a non-contender in the Reds to, I guess, a contender. Again, I've been saying that I don't believe the Mets are going to be a playoff team all year. But nonetheless, you still have to call them a contender. So he goes from a losing team to a winning team, and I think people's initial reaction is that that's a good thing. But he leaves a very friendly hitter's park in Cincinnati, where he's leading the league in RBIs, to a Mets offense that really, really struggles. Who knows defensively where he's going to play and what the impact is there. But he's also changing teams, and like you said, a lot of times changes environment don't do well for players. It was worked wonders for Suspedes last year, but I don't know if we should expect that from Bruce or not. What's the impact on him changing from being a Red to being a Met?
Yeah, we're hearing in New York that originally he was going to be asked to play right field. Now they're hedging a little bit. Oh, we might have to see how he feels about playing center. Oh, boy, that doesn't sound good to me at all. All these people keep telling me, oh, the ballpark doesn't make a difference. Are you kidding? Of course it makes a difference. The question is how big a difference does it make? There's a reason why we call it the Great American Small Park. Okay, the ball flies out of there and it's small. City Field, okay, they brought the fences in. It's not the Grand Canyon it used to be. It's still not a hitter's ballpark, and the ball does not travel well there. So it will make a difference. There's going to be a lot of pressure on Bruce. You know, he's going to be looked at by Mets fans to be the savior again, like Yoenis Cespedes was last year. And I don't see this happening. Not like that. You know, I think he'll be good. If he would have been on one of the better teams, even on the Nationals or the Cubs, he'd be an MVP candidate right now. But because the Reds and also ran team, a team that wasn't going anywhere, you know, we just mentioned his numbers, but don't mention how good he's been. So, you know, how does he handle the pennant race? I think he's happy to go. I think he'll be fine. But to say that his numbers won't be impacted somewhat, of course they will be. Not to mention the Mets have no one to hit around him.
Wade Miley goes from a pitcher's park to an extremely friendly hitter's park in one of the worst divisions of baseball for pitchers, especially lefties. You don't want to be a lefty at Fenway Park, and you just don't want to be in the AL East in general for most pitchers. But he goes from a good park to a bad park, but he goes from a non-contender to a possible division winner. Wade Miley to Baltimore. Impact?
This just lets you know how desperate Baltimore was for a starting pitcher. I don't see this ending well at all. You hit all the necessary points here. He's going to get wrecked. Bottom line is he's going to get wrecked in that park here. He might have a good start here and there, but he's another guy. At best case scenario, he's a matchup guy. Who's he playing? Where's he playing? That'll determine whether I'm going to start him or not. I want very little to do with him unless I'm desperate.
Tyler Culper was traded to the Yankees. Is Betances definitely the closer there, or would the Yankees maybe just want to leave Betances where he is and maybe let Clifford close it out since it looks like the Yankees probably aren't going to be contenders?
No, Betances is definitely the closer. No reason to worry about that. Little surprised they picked up Clifford. I'm not so sure how much sense that made because he signed for next year, too, at $6 million. So I'm a little surprised that the Yankees would make this move. Clifford, the former Yankee, that's who he came up with. He's the middle reliever. He'll be there with Adam Warren, you know, seventh, eighth innings there to help out to get to Betances. But Betances is by far the guy you want.
Andrew Miller has made it clear that he's a team player. He'll pitch out of any role that any team wants to give him. And it's opened the door to the possibility that maybe the Indians play the situations at least part of the time rather than stick Cody Allen is eighth and Andrew Miller is ninth. What's your read on that? Is Andrew Miller always going to be the closer, or could we have a situation where Cody Allen still retains some closer value and maybe Miller's is reduced a little?
I think this all depends on what Terry Francona wants to do because he has options. You mentioned Miller has no problem setting up. He's not a head case, doesn't have a big ego. Oh, I got to close, or so I'm going to cry and go home. He has no problem setting up. He goes, hey, it's my job. I get paid to pitch the 8th, 9th, 7th. He doesn't care. So I think this is going to be very curious what happens here. Terry Francona is being very coy. He's not saying, which is smart. You know, they don't want to give away any information. Why don't the other managers know here? My guess is Miller closes if I had to bet. But I don't know about you. I think you and I feel the same way here. If I'm Francona, all right, the 8th inning is all righties. All right, Allen's coming in the 8th. If it's the 9th and he was all righties, then Allen gets the 9th. Vice versa for Miller. I want to do what's best for my team. You know, if it's even, you know, well, one inning has two lefties, the other inning has one, then maybe Miller gets the benefit of the doubt and he closes. He's the better pitcher there. But other than that, I'm trying to win games. I want to win a World Series. I'm doing what's best for my team, and I know I don't have to worry with Miller about him freaking out, about him complaining. He's not going to do it. We throw Jarvin Pavlov on with him. He's not going to be one of those types. Either I close or I'm terrible. So I think he has that option as well. So I think if I had to hedge, Chris, I'd go Miller. But I do not think this is written in stone. I think we're all waiting to see when the next save situation happens. And you might need to see two or three save situations to really figure it out.
Yeah, I think there's a mental block when it comes to closers in the ninth inning. For some reason, Craig Kimbrell can't pitch in non-save situations. I don't know why that is, but he just time and time again, when put into those positions, he doesn't perform well. It doesn't make any rational sense. When you're pitching in a meaningful spot, whether it's a save or not, you should be able to perform, and Andrew Miller can. But for some reason, Craig Kimbrell can't. I don't know why that is. But for a manager, I can understand how you feel comfortable. Miller's your ninth, and Allen's your eighth, or vice versa. I can understand why everyone would feel comfortable with just putting guys in their roles, and it's just simple, it's uniform, it's boilerplate. I can understand that. But managers should get over it and do exactly what you said, which is if you got three lefties in the eighth, you don't bring in Allen, and then when Miller comes in the ninth, he faces righties. It doesn't make any sense to do that. Now, Miller's dominant against everybody, so it doesn't really matter for that. But it does probably make sense for Allen, and it probably makes sense for the bullpen in general. And across baseball, it probably should be that way. But it just seems like a mental block that managers don't feel comfortable doing what they should do because they're so used to what they've always done. But I agree with you, they should, but it just seems like they're making a decision they don't feel good about. It just doesn't feel right in their gut, and so they're reluctant to do that. But Andrew Miller has made it a lot easier for managers to do that, and Terry Francona is a pretty flexible guy. So I think that helps a lot. If you got Craig Kimbrell, who's proven he can't pitch in non-save situations, then even though he should come in the eighth sometimes, it makes the decision easy. You just don't do it. Andrew Miller says he's comfortable. The numbers show that he's always comfortable in any situation. He could pitch in the second inning and be great. He could probably start and throw three or four innings if you really wanted him to. I mean, Miller truly can do everything extremely well. So he makes it a lot easier for a manager to do what he should do rather than just insert guys into their roles. But I do think Cody Allen still has some value. And in some leagues, if you don't have a closer and some guy cuts Allen, just like I cut Brad Ziegler as soon as Kimbrell was activated from the DL. I don't think he'll get any more saves. I think Cody Allen will get more saves than the typical eighth inning guy will get, but obviously his value has been decreased a lot. Matt Kelly in Atlanta, I think I know what you're going to say. I want to ask, what's the impact of him leaving San Diego, who stinks? He goes to the Braves, who maybe stink even worse, and maybe the lineup is even worse. But what's the fancy impact of the Padres essentially selling Kemp to the Braves?
Well, that's really what it was, right? It was pretty much salary. You know, the Herrera went back to San Diego, and they quickly dumped him for his problems. Kemp was having a solid year, you know, so I don't think it's a bad move for Atlanta. I might be a little bit surprised that they would want Kemp, but once again, I think they just want to get rid of Herrera and get rid of that albatross. But, you know, Kemp, 260 batting average, all right, not great, but, you know, that 23 home runs, 69 RBIs, solid numbers. He doesn't run anymore, but solid numbers there, and they need all the pop they can get. I mean, outside of Freddie Freeman, most average fans probably can't name another Atlanta Braves. You know, so I get it here. They are opening up a new stadium next year. They need someone to, headline, you know, Freeman, Kent. You know, maybe they do end up making that trade for Brian McCann from the Yankees, too, to bring back another hometown hero. So I don't mind the move. I think Kemp sort of gets a bad rap sometimes, and he's, oh, my God, he's terrible. Like I said, the numbers aren't terrible. You know, I mean, the average, yes, it isn't quite there what it used to be. You know, you like to see him do it a little bit more. His outfield play has deteriorated. He's still, if you're going to bat 260 and hit 35 home runs, a lot of teams are going to take that.
Yeah, I think the one place is the advanced metrics. And on-base percentage isn't really an advanced metric, but I think on-base tells you something about a player that the counting stats like home runs and stolen bases don't. And his on-base is like 285. I mean, I've heard Keith Law say that if you can't have an on-base of at least 300, then you're a negative player no matter what you're doing. And Kemp is under 300, and he's at about 285. So you say, yep, the home runs are there. The batting average is actually 260. I mean, a lot of guys hit 260. That's not a good average, but that's almost kind of normal. I mean, it's pretty sad today what batting averages are. So 260 is actually not all that bad. But 285 on-base, that is pretty terrible. And he's not a good defensive player anymore. At one point, he was a center fielder. Now he's probably even a bad left fielder. So from a baseball perspective, you look at those and say, yeah, the numbers like the ones say one thing, but these other ones kind of suggest something else. I think that's really the argument behind it. Two quick guys here in the outfield and the infield. We talked about Eduardo Nunez a little bit. He's having a surprisingly really good year. Now he goes to a team who's winning, goes from a bad hitter's park to another bad hitter's park. But what do you think about Nunez and the Giants and his role and maybe his gained eligibility and all the seasons he's having? And also Melvin Upton Jr. He was having a really sneaky good season with the Padres. Now he goes to Toronto, and it looks like of all the guys that were traded, his value may be hurt the most. I'm curious, what do you think about Nunez and Upton Jr.?
Well, when Nunez was originally acquired, we were wondering where he was going to play. And he had no place to play, you know, though, with Duffy and Panic returning. So that was a little bit of a surprise they'd go there. I know we heard that already he'll be a super utility player. Well, the Yankees had tried that with him, and he wasn't really good in the outfield. He had some issues out there. Now, it ends up working out now. They traded Duffy, so Nunez does have a place to play. You already mentioned it. He's not the greatest defender. Yeah, he's not even close. You know, average may be pushing it a little bit. So in the end, that might hurt him a little bit. He does run, so maybe he gives you that kind of player that gives you speed on the bases there. And he's had a little bit of pop with Minnesota. Don't know if that'll continue over with San Fran. Like I said, it's okay. Nothing great there. If Nunez is available, I want him for his speed. I think he's going to continue to run. So that's what I'm looking for there, stolen bases. As for Upton, another guy, we just don't know if he's going to play every day. He's going to be play 3 out of 4 days, be a defensive replacement. His value is the same to me. He's hitting a little better. He was with San Diego. Now he goes back to the American League East. Run. Let him run the bags. We're stealing some bags there. But he's not going to play every day. And that value gets limited some. So you wonder how that's going to be as well. Everyone seems to be healthy now in Toronto. So I don't know if Melvin's really going to give you a great deal there. He's only played what? I'm looking at his stats now. He's only played 2 of the past 6 games. So that's a problem as well. You just don't know if he's going to get game in, game out. Is he going to play with Toronto? I don't think he is. Yeah, I don't. I think he's not a platoon guy. I just think he's a guy that they'll work in to give some of their regular players rest. But I don't want to go back to the Sanchez thing. But now Toronto's going to have to worry, really lean on their hitting if they're going to put Sanchez in the bullpen. And I don't know how much he's going to play over Saunders or Pilar. They're not going to take Pilar out. They love his defense. Saunders is hitting. Bautista is certainly not going to come out. You got to come out Saunders at first. You know, it would shuffle things out around an awful lot to put him in the outfield for Bautista at DH. I guess you could do this. I guess Toronto has options, but until they figure it out, like I said, unless I need speed, I'm staying away.
Last question, and we're going to get you out of here. Drew Pomeranz goes from the Padres to the Red Sox in one of the more interesting, controversial trades that was done early enough that we were able to pick it apart individually, and a lot of people had a lot of things to say about it. I think most people, when they see a player go from a non-contender to a contender, they almost assume that the change will be positive, unless a guy's going to lose playing time or something like that. If there's something obvious like that, then obviously the opinions change. But I think in general, the initial reaction is that when you go to a contender, that's a positive change. But Pomeranz leaves a pretty good pitcher's park. He leaves the National League. He's going to face the DH. And he goes to a park like Fenway Park where it doesn't really treat lefties very well. Matter of fact, it usually is extremely poorly. It's a bad introduction to lefties. Let's put it that way. What are your thoughts with Pomeranz coming to the Red Sox? He should get some win opportunities, but Fenway Park, AL East, American League, designated hitter, that's a lot to overcome to say that this is a good change. What are your thoughts on Pomeranz leaving the National League and coming to the Sox?
Well, like I said, unless I needed wins, I don't like it. You know, certainly he's going to get a much better chance to go get a W with Boston as the offense will score some runs. But his ratios are all going to take a hit. The ERA is going to go up. The whip's going to go up. Strikeouts, that could remain the same. But the upside's limited now. I said, if you need a W, it's great. You know, but if I was a Pomeranz owner, you know, it really depends on when I'm looking at my categories. Now, ERA and whip at this point in the season may be protected. You know, if you're up by a certain amount of points, you're not going to, you know, Pomeranz is not going to destroy them. You know, so it really depends on where you are in ERA and whip. But the K's, I think it's a little bit of an aberration. You look at as far as starts with Boston, it's really one good, one bad, one good, one bad. And the bads have been against the Angels and the Giants. Not exactly powerhouse offensive teams. So that concerns me somewhat. I always wonder with guys, you know, when they pitch in Fenway, do they get scared of the monster? You know, I know that sounds funny, but, you know, you look out there, wow, that thing is really close. I got to make sure that I don't throw the ball inside at all. You know, nobody can pull the ball, and you pitch differently. You know, you don't pitch the way you're – what made you successful. So I wonder if that takes – you know, it's mental. You know, it gets it in your head there, but how you have to avoid that monster. So, like I said, bottom line is it comes down to me, do you need the W's? If you need the W's, it's good for you. If you're worried about your ratios, then it's bad for you.
George Kurtz, baseball, football, hockey expert from rotoexperts.com. Appreciate you taking a lot more time than we should have held you. I probably rambled too much early on with the hose thing and the beer thing and the bacon thing, and we didn't get to talk as quite as much baseball as you like, but you put in more than enough time for us today. Really appreciate it. Thanks a lot. You can follow George at George Kurtz. But, George, thanks a lot for joining us today, and look forward to having you back on later at a more reasonable length than we were able to do today.
All right. Good luck, everybody, and enjoy your football drafts.
Yeah. That's George Kurtz. Again, you can follow him on Twitter at George Kurtz. If you want his fantasy hockey, football, and baseball conversations, head on over to rotoexperts.com. Football season, football drafts, football prep is definitely in swing, and George provides content over at rotoexperts.com for that. So I highly recommend you head over there. He's also on SiriusXM Radio as well as Fantasy Network Radio. So head on over to Twitter, find his feed, and find the ways that you can get in touch with him and talk with him and converse with him and listen to him, because he brings some pretty good stuff to the fantasy world. I'm Chris Mitchell, your host of a podcast to be named later. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in today. If you want to follow me or the program, there are lots of different places you can do that. If you want to read my baseball content, you can head on over to minorleagueball.com. I post these podcasts over there. I also post content. I post a Who to Watch article pretty much every single day. I pick five or six players or matchups that are worth watching that day, and I give my take on why. I try to bring it a little bit different. I try to make the takes relevant. Today, we've got Dylan Bundy as part of that Who to Watch. Also, there's a pretty good matchup with the Marlins and the Mets. No, it's the Marlins and the Cubs. I apologize. Jose Fernandez heading up against that vaunted Cubs offense. Possibly a playoff preview, or at the very least, it'll be an interesting look at the Cubs offense. Can they mash their way to a World Series? Now, they're pitching pretty well, but when they face the Strasburgs and the Scherzers and possibly the Syndergaards and maybe a Darvishan or a Hamels, how do the Cubs offense hold up? You may get a glimpse of that tonight when you see Marlins versus Cubs. So that's one of them to watch. Dylan Bundy in his fourth start as a starter with the Baltimore Orioles. They really need some quality pitching out of that rotation. And Dylan Bundy needs to prove he can be a starter. I'm not so sure he can, because he's had so many injuries over the years, and he's transitioning pretty quickly, kind of on the fly, from a reliever to a starter, because the Orioles had to keep him in the majors this year. He wasn't ready to start when this year, so they had to start him as a reliever and kind of slowly ease them into being a starter. So he's already started three games. Now he's up to his fourth. I think he was probably on a pitch count early. I think that pitch count is now gone, and we'll see how he handles things. Can he be a starter? Can he handle a 200 workload kind of pace? Can he pitch six or seven innings every 5 days, including the middle days where you do some work and the side sessions, things like that? Can he throw that much and stay healthy? I think Dylan Bundy is an interesting guy because as a prospect, very highly touted, lots of potential. The stuff looks pretty good. I don't know if he looks like what he was supposed to be when he was at his highest, when he was drafted out of high school. But the stuff looks a little bit better than it has recently, so it looks like maybe that's coming around. He's a guy that I think is very interesting. Alex Bregman, another one. He's 1-for-28. Everyone was extremely excited to see him being promoted to Houston. He was tearing up the minor league. While I thought he was a good prospect, I wasn't sure if he was an elite guy. Last year's draft was not that strong. There were a lot of middle infielders, and it looks like now last year's draft was actually a lot better than we thought at the time. At the time, we thought it was a terrible draft. Then we slowly came around to the idea that it was a bad draft. And then in my podcast that I spoke with Jim Callis, and you can actually access that link in any of my articles over at leagueball.com. I put the links to the podcasts that are most recent. And I did one with MLB.com's Jim Callis, who does all that prospect work. He really put minor league prospect on the map, on the media map. He's really the leader in prospect talk, and he does it over at MLB.com now. And I had him on the show, and we were kind of analyzing just what was last year's draft. And it was actually pretty good. There were a lot of middle infielders drafted, and my initial reaction to that was that a lot of middle infielders were drafted because there just weren't a lot of impact players, either pitchers or offensive players. So therefore, it encouraged teams to go after guys who could possibly increase their value by playing in the middle and being able to defend the position. Now it just looks like they're pretty good. Brendan Rodgers looks pretty good. Alex Bregman looks exceptional. Dansby Swanson is getting a lot of love. I don't know if he deserves it or not, but he's growing in people's minds even more so than he was when he was drafted last year. Andrew Benintendi is going to start for the Red Sox on Wednesday night. He was promoted today. He's not going to start against a lefty, but he's going to get his debut on Wednesday against a right-hander, Hisashi Irakuma, against the Mariners. He's not a middle infielder, but he's a guy who was just drafted last season, having a nice season in the minors so far. So last year's draft is looking better and better. The podcast that I talk about with Jim Callis is over there at minorleagueball.com. But tonight, Alex Bregman is going up against a knuckler. It's tough to get a read on how good or bad a person is when you're facing a knuckler, but he's 1-for-28. So maybe the change from fastballs and curveballs to flutters and knuckles, maybe that is a change that will help him. I don't know, but we're speculating about that, and I write about that over there today. So if you want, you can get all of my content, whether it's podcasts or written articles, at minorleagueball.com. You can also head on to rotoexperts.com, where I write about the fantasy value of minor league prospects. My next article is going to be examining all the prospects that were traded in this deadline, or at least all the relevant ones. That should be posted here in the next 2 or 3 days, so take a look out for that. If you want to talk baseball with me, we can do it in the long form over there on Facebook. It's a podcast to be named later. Or if you just want the easy way, if you want to take it the lazy way, head on over to Twitter, at CJMitch73. I tweet out my own stuff. I forward other things that I think are worthy of some reading. So at CJMitch73 on my Twitter feed. And if you want access to my podcast, or you just want to talk to me and ask questions, or if you want to find out where you can find my content, I can just direct you right there on Twitter rather than you going to minorleagueball.com or rotoexperts.com. That's the way it is. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. Hopefully you had a good fantasy agenda here of a podcast to be in order. Tomorrow, we're on with Brandon C. Williams. We're going to talk about the deadline from a baseball perspective. We tried to focus mostly fantasy today. Tomorrow, we're going to be focusing mostly baseball. Look at the divisions. Look at the impact of the additions or the subtractions. Some of the deals that should have happened and didn't. Some of the players that should have moved and didn't. Some of the surprises. We talked about some of the surprises today, but I'll get Brandon C. Williams' take on those as well from that perspective. A Texas guy and the Rangers were a pretty big part of the deadline yesterday, while the Astros were not. So we'll go down to Texas and get his thoughts on that. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. Enjoy your day. Be good and enjoy your baseball, everybody. Thanks a lot.